Hey everyone, Mike Carroll here from the Required Reading Podcast. Want to wish everybody a happy summer. I know it's been a little while since we've put one of our podcasts out, but Nick Hoffman and I were talking about trying to get a little bit of original content out there for you guys. So here I am in our recording studio, middle of the summer, because I'm going to read through one of the short stories that I wrote. For those of you that listen to the podcast, you might know a little bit about A Wrong Cruelly Done. It's a short story that I wrote last year that was picked up and will be coming out in a literary magazine in December. So I'm going to go ahead and read through this. I'll give a little bit of some of the background of the story before really getting started. And then if you listen through all the way to the end, I'll give a little bit of a teaser for the first of the novels that we will be covering once the next season of Required Reading really kicks off. So some exciting stuff coming down the pipe for you guys, and I'm here to kick off some original content with A Wrong Cruelly Done. So again, this is a short story that I wrote. It follows along Loki's role in the death of Herebald by his brother Hephaestion. Again, for those of you that listen along to the podcast, you know just how much I love Beowulf. So this is a more modern interpretation of that tragic death from the epic poem. This one is set in the early 1970s in Northern Ireland. So what you guys are about to get is a first time reading through of this story. I'm gonna start it off and just make our way through it. So I apologize. I am far from a paid reader for any sort of audiobook company. So kind of what you hear is what you're gonna get. Here we go. We're just gonna jump right into it. Again, this is A Wrong Cruelly Done by Michael C. Carroll. An arrow from a horned bow missed the mark and shot his kinsman, one brother the other, with a bloody dart. That was an expiable killing, a wrong cruelly done. Beowulf, lines 2437 to 2441. Belfast, December 10th, 1971. The flames in the Belfast pub's fireplace flickered with each opening of the tavern door. Northern Ireland's most decorated officers hung from portrait frames on the tattered walls, while the dim lamps guarding the room's perimeter cast their dull beams across the floorboards. Throughout the bar, cigarettes balanced on ashtray rims, their smoke billowing toward the ceiling like a dozen funeral pyres, drifting skyward before seeping into the overhead panels. The young Irishman standing by the bar reached into his trousers to retrieve his wallet. With fingers still stiff from the cold, it took all his dexterity to pry open the folds. A disheartened expression consumed his face. No glimmering coins glowed within, no identification card declaring his name, no rogue English pound, only a book of matches stared back from the leathery depths. Accepting that the whiskey he desired was not a feasible option, the Irishman plucked from his jacket a pouch of hand-rolled cigarettes. His whiskey would have to wait until his brother's arrival. Rolling back his sleeves, the Irishman reached for an unoccupied ashtray. With the Northern Statesmen scowling from their frames above, he unfastened the pouch and gazed upon the finest cigarettes Peterson's Dublin storefront could offer. They were stunningly precise, each adhesive seal as straight as an arrow, each tube a perfect replica of its brethren, each cylinder aligned dutifully at attention, all save one. One cigarette faced the opposite way, the rebel cigarette, a superstition he and his brother upheld since their days lifting packs from the Dublin marts. With every pouch, they flipped a cigarette. As the years passed, his brother's time living north of the border made him partial to the sweeter tobacco of the Murray and Sons Company. But despite their brand preferences, brothers always smoked the rebel cigarette last. It was more than a good luck charm. It was a reminder that someday their souls will spill skyward from their lungs and ascend to taverns unknown. His rebel cigarette would stand guard, protecting that pouch until the day he died. His brothers would do the same. Glancing around at the flags that filled the Belfast pub, with their red crosses and their red hands beneath their red crowns, the Dubliner felt not unlike that rebel cigarette. What would the bartender do if he knew their plan? What would those framed statesmen glaring from above do if they heard his nationalist heart pounding beneath his sweater? Would they have him tied to a prison post? The bells tethered to the pub door snapped the Irishman from his trance. He knew without turning who had entered. There could be no mistaking that off-key whistling of the foggy dew. A thin smile spread across the Dubliner's face as his older brother clasped a firm hand on his shoulder and pulled back the stool alongside him. Jostling the cubes of his whiskey glass, the Irishman donned his coat and glanced around the closing tavern. Like the flames from the fireplace, the lamps that lined the paneled walls flickered and went dark. The light-haired gentleman, who had taken the nearest bar stool, had already flung his scarf around his neck and left through the tavern door. A stream of inky liquid trailed across the wet bar top where the bartender must have dragged his brother's bill. All that remained upon the bar were the Irishman's gloves, a set of damp coasters, and his brother's cigarettes, the precious property he guarded while his brother finished in the bathroom. After his final sip, the young Irishman plunged his hands into his gloves and looked toward the bathroom door for any sign of his brother. They had entered the bar separately, and while he wished to bid his accomplice farewell, it was far more important that they not be seen leaving together. That was when they heard the oak door chime. Like water spewing from a narrow hose, a steady stream of Garda spilled across the tavern's threshold. The young Irishman only had time to grab his brother's cigarettes before the firm glove of a Northern Irish policeman seized him by the collar and flung him to the ground. With his cheeks pressed against the Guinness-soaked floorboards, the last thing the Dubliner remembered seeing was a gigantic officer kicking through the door of the bar's water closet. Belfast, December 11th, 1971. From the sparse beams of light penetrating the cloudy window of his cell, the Irishman could not decipher the hour when he awoke. Far more tangible than the time, however, were the bruises that darkened his cheeks. His mouth tasted of iron. A bloody stream trickled from his molars, forming a sticky pool beneath his tongue. Touching his cheek, a jolt of sharp pain engulfed his face. He cringed as he remembered how the Garda officer had thrust his jaw onto the shards of whiskey glass on the tavern floor. Despite his pain, the Dubliner was already deciphering what had happened. Which tavern goer had overheard their conversation? Was his brother nursing wounds in an adjacent cell? Would this derail their plans? The Dubliner deemed these riddles unsolvable without the aid of his cigarettes. The clang of keys at the cell door interrupted his musings. When the iron hinges creaked open, a tall man stepped through the entrance. The Irishman kept his focus upon the concrete floor. Before long, however, he allowed his gaze to travel from the man's pristine leather shoes up his trousers to his tidy tweed overcoat. The Irishman's first impression was that the man seemed like a figure transported from a distant past, from some otherworldly or other history. The mysterious man tucked his wool cap under his arm and opened a manila folder. "I suppose I should begin with an introduction," the tall man ran a hand through his blonde hair. "Good morning, sir. My name is Lewis. Detective Lewis. I'm assigned to your case." The Irishman said nothing. Detective Lewis peered at the prisoner over the top of his folder and calmly retrieved a document before speaking again. "Before we continue, you should know that I'm not affiliated with the Northern Irish government, nor am I associated with the Irish Republic. I was born in Sweden." Still, the Irishman said nothing. "Belfast keeps a few of us Northerners on retainer for special cases. You and your brother represent the kind of puzzle I tend to solve. Cases of unknown identities. I believe you Irishmen would refer to them as a Sean Doe, would you not?" The exhausted Dubliner bit the corner of his lip to keep from smiling. Cases of unknown identity. Their names remained a mystery. Retrieving the slip from the manila folder, the detective pulled a pair of thin-framed glasses from his pocket. "Judging from your tranquility, I assume you'll have no issue with me reading the transcript of your arrest from last night." The Irishman dropped his gaze back to the concrete floor and remained silent. "Excellent." Detective Lewis held the parchment to the light that spilled from the cell's window. "December 10th, two Irish males, approximate age 25. Both men had medium builds and short, dark hair. Neither criminal held identification papers." "Criminal." The investigator lowered the transcript. "That's a bit harsh, don't you think?" The Dubliner was too headstrong to take the bait. Nevertheless, he appreciated the detective's empathetic tone. "Record of arrest." Detective Lewis continued. "Belfast officer. Sir, you are under arrest. Put the glass down and put your hands behind your back." The detective was enjoying the charade. "All right, sounds reasonable." You replied with, "Get your tanny hands off me, you loyalist bastard." Eloquent. The transcript somehow reinvigorated the wound on the Irishman's cheek. "Excellent. There's more on the back. The detective turned the page with a dramatic furrow. Belfast officer, we will use force if you act belligerently. To which he responded, eat shit, you copper prick. Ah, that one has a nice ring to it, the detective smiled. Criminal was then lowered from his bar stool to the floor. Bit of a euphemism there. Yes, but here we are, the final act, the denouement. Belfast officer, where's your brother? And you replied with, get your hands off me, you throne-worshipping fuck. Wow, bravo, a masterpiece. Paints quite the picture, doesn't it? Neatly tucking the paperwork into the folder, Detective Lewis sat upon the untouched sheets that covered the inmate's bed. Look, the investigator said, rubbing his brow thoughtfully. I've been in the business long enough. At this time, as the years have passed, I found myself caring less and less about the people and more about solving these riddles, you see? So this may come as a surprise to you, but I don't really care about what you are or what flag you salute. The stark confession caught the Irishman's attention like a hook ensnaring the lip of a trout. The Dubliner propped his back against the wall and dabbed the wound on his cheek contemplatively. Tapping the manila folder, the detective continued, I don't take every case Belfast sends my way. There needs to be something that impassions me. And what I found most intriguing about your case is the statistics. Let's take a look. Nudging his glasses up his nose, the detective plucked a fresh sheet from his folder. September 19th. Car bomb. Finnegan's Pharmacy. Casualties, 0. Injured, 0. October 5th. Car bomb. O'Sheen's Tavern. Casualties, 0. Injured, 0. November 1st. Car bomb. Donegal Street. Thrift store. Casualties, 0. Injured, 0. November 28th. Car bomb. O'Connor's Jewelry. Casualties, 0. Injured, 0. Four explosions in the past 3 months. Before each explosion, the shop owners received a sprig of mistletoe in an envelope. After each explosion, dozens of witnesses reported a masked man clearing the streets of pedestrians prior to the blast. Each explosion completely decimated a known loyalist business, yet the explosions left nobody harmed. Not one casualty. Quite impressive, if you ask me. Detective Lewis snapped his glasses shut and slid them into his coat pocket. These mistletoe brothers, that's what they've been deemed by the Belfast papers, seemed to me more like patriots than vigilantes. And were you to ask me what I thought about their casualty-free revolutionary cause, I'd say that throughout what feels like centuries of cases, I might have found a pair of like-minded souls. I think we should be asking how we could make these brothers more comfortable, he added after a pause, more like the heroes I believe them to be. When the investigator stood to his towering height, the Irishman thought the Swede must have come from a line of mythological giants. The Dubliner stood to meet the detective's calculated stare. After a long exhale, the detective turned to leave, but stopped when he heard the Dubliner's voice. Cigarettes. Pardon? His position kept the prisoner from seeing the smile that spread across his face. In a voice worn raw with clotted blood, the Irishman spoke. You asked what could make those brothers feel more comfortable. Cigarettes. Bring the pouch of cigarettes from my jacket the night of the arrest, the Murray and Sons pouch. Give me a cigarette and I'll talk. Detective Lewis gave the Irishman a nod before setting the lock and disappearing into the darkness. Belfast, December 18th, 1971. Come along now. I've visited enough this week for you to know that I would ask. The Irishman kept his attention in his lap. While he enjoyed the investigator's visits, whenever Detective Lewis was present, a nervous sensation overtook the Dubliner's body. Look, the investigator plucked a page from his folder. I'm more interested in solving the case than I am punishing a pair of brothers with political leanings not far from my own. Why don't I simply tell you what I've deduced from your case? Don't say anything, just keep puffing on that cigarette. Sound like a plan? The Irishman said nothing. Excellent. The detective rubbed his palms together enthusiastically. I'll take your silence for begrudging compliance. Let's see here. Where to begin? I suppose we should start where the Belfast Garda gave up, can't we? Poor lads packed it in when your file came back empty. The detective addressed the Irishman, but his attention remained on the file. No ID, no residential records, no medical history, not so much as a dentist appointment anywhere from Donegal to Cork. Nothing. While Belfast's finest took those absences as a reason to throw away your case, I drew a different conclusion. You're orphans. Not wanting his expression to reveal his shock, the Irishman scratched his chin inquisitively. pacing the small cell. The detective pointed with his pen to the plates of scrap by the door. "I've noticed that every time I visit, you leave your potatoes untouched. Strange habit for an Irishman, until you consider how often the Republic orphanages serve potatoes. Makes sense. Abundant. Simple to prepare. But I imagine a pair of teenagers growing up in Dublin group homes would have tired of the national delicacy, right?" The detective knew he was right. "Now the fun begins. Where do these mysterious mistletoe brothers reside?" he continued, without giving the prisoner time to respond. Admittedly, this had me stumped for some time. That was before I realized I needed to consider multiple locations. "These," the investigator tossed the sealed pack of Peterson's rolled cigarettes into the Irishman's lap, "can only be purchased in Dublin, while these," his brother's Murray and Sons pouch thudded on the prison floor, "are only sold on the Belfast docks. Interesting. Our beloved mistletoe brothers must live in different cities." Which explains a lot. Detective Lewis continued pacing, because even the most inept policeman would not let that many vehicles and that much gunpowder go unreported. Which presented the question of how you acquired the material in the first place. For that, we turned to the docks. It was like watching a prodigious midfielder dribble across the pitch. Every decision was calculated, each movement performed with precision. Every breath served a precious and secret purpose. "If you can believe it, your gloves gave this one away." Detective Lewis tucked his folder under his arm and looked intensely at his upturned hands. "Gloves you wore the night of your arrest were torn across the palms, rubbed thin by the thick docking ropes. Incredible. But that wasn't the best part. Embedded in the wet cloth of these gloves, I found tiny dark grains. Gunpowder." All the Irishman could do was stare in awe. The detective had methodically unraveled the tangled coil he and his brother had spent years binding. Shaking his head with disbelief, the prisoner could only listen and learn how far the investigator had traveled down their carefully constructed rabbit hole. That was my favorite part. The detective pretended not to see the Irishman's incredulous expression. Repurposed British gunpowder. Car bombs born with loyalist ingredients. You were blowing up Belfast with their own damn explosives. "And for your grand finale," the detective's voice rose triumphantly, "you used German vehicles, fresh off the boat from Berlin. Your brother illegally parked them and had them towed from the Belfast docks. Once they were unclaimed, because, well, nobody owned them, he paid for their rescue from the junkyard. I found the expired parking slips in your trousers." "Magnificent," the detective said. "I knew the mistletoe brothers would not disappoint. But the riddle is not yet solved." The detective's voice suddenly became serious. The Irishman inhaled sharply, trying not to show his nerve. In a flash, the Swede's glare was insatiable, its wrath piercing, his manners terrifying. The Irishman trembled. Then, Detective Lewis breathed deeply and smiled at the prisoner. His ferocity vanished. His placid demeanor returned. With a snap of his reading glasses, the investigator sighed. "Well, despite all of that, three facts still elude me. The identities of these mistletoe brothers, their upcoming targets, and their method of communication. Now, before you get all upset, I know you'll never reveal your brother's identity," the detective admitted. "But if I were to guarantee your release by Christmas for providing any pertinent information, would you reconsider complying?" The young Irishman peeked down at his brother's pouch of rolled cigarettes on the prison floor and saw the rebel cigarettes staring back. The Irishman shook his head. "Very well, then," the investigator sported a mischievous grin. "The game persists." Long after Detective Lewis latched the door, the Dubliner could hear the hiss of the investigator's final word reverberating from the walls of his cell. Belfast, December 24th, 1971. The Irishman could not tell whether it was dawn or dusk when he awoke to the sound of the Swedish footfalls. Immediately, something about Detective Lewis's gait did not feel right. When the investigator entered the cell, he seemed uncharacteristically disheveled. Whatever news he had could not wait. "Sorry for the early visit," the detective exhaled to gain his composure, "but there's been a development in your case." Sitting upright, the Dubliner rubbed his brow. The feeble rays that spilled from the foggy window indicated that the sun had not yet risen. "I'll get right to the point," another long breath. "Despite the patriotic silence you have upheld, your brother has had a change of heart. In exchange for his release, he agreed to reveal your identities." From his folder, Detective Lewis pulled a single sheet of paper. "That's impossible," the Irishman's voice croaked with skepticism, dragging his legs to the edge of the cot. He reached for the document. Pinched between the detective's forefinger and thumb was the pouch of Murray and Sons cigarettes. The Dubliner had found that his taste had changed during his imprisonment. "It's true. At this moment, your brother's meeting with the Belfast police. They are arranging the terms of his release. The document in your hand was drafted last night by the commissioner himself and initialed by your brother shortly thereafter. Look for yourself at the bottom. I believe you'll recognize your brother's hand. The detective paused. I'm sorry to bring you such unfortunate news. He could not look at the Irishman. An expression of empathy covered his face. As the Dubliner examined the file, the world around him changed. The sparse rays of light from the rising sun seemed to darken and fade. The concrete walls surrounding him felt cold and thick. Somewhere beyond the muddy cell window, a crow barked and sang. The detective's voice grew indecipherably muffled, like the words of an important sermon heard underwater. The Dubliner stared at what was undeniably his brother's signature at the foot of the page, the letters C and D with a sword underneath, raining droplets of blood from the hilt. As lead investigator on this case, an admirer of a devoted patriot, I think it best to explain your options. The investigator slid to the floor. The Dubliner nodded his head but said nothing. His attention remained fixed on the letters and sword carved like a scar upon the page. This file diminishes your leverage, but you can still walk free if you reveal your brother's identity, along with any information pertaining to future explosions. Your brother, for whatever reason, was unable or unwilling to disclose those plans. But I must make whatever deal I can immediately. Once your brother exposes you, which that document says he will, my hands will be tied. The Irishman said nothing. Look, the detective lowered the document the Irishman clutched. Over these past 3 weeks, I have come to admire your tenacity, but more than your rebelliousness, I have come to respect your unwavering dedication to your brother. That is a love that I will never know. But I can tell you with absolute certainty that if you don't reveal his identity, they'll have you killed. They'll drag you down that forsaken hall, they'll tie you to that post, right there in the courtyard, and they'll fill your chest with enough bullets to stop your patriotic heart. I, for one, don't want to see that happen. What should I do? For the first time since he took his brother's confession, the prisoner lifted his attention from the signature seared upon the page. His hand shook as he lowered the paper. Tears soaked the rims of his eyes. Ultimately, that decision is yours. The detective rose to leave. With his hand poised on the door, he stopped. The light from the murky window illuminated a tattoo of the Swedish flag on his forearm. Were you to ask me, not as a detective, but as a friend, I would suggest that you give them the information. Your brother made his choice. You can clearly see where his allegiances reside. Choose life, Dubliner, and keep that rebel heart beating. There's no limit to what a passionate heart can do. Your brother lost sight of that. Don't succumb to the same fate. Wait. Detective Lewis's hand was on the latch when the prisoner spoke. Without saying another word, the Irishman opened his brother's pouch of cigarettes. From his lap, the rebel cigarette peered back at the Dubliner proudly. Taking the delicate paper, the Irishman held the cigarette up to the dull morning light. He stared in silence. In the years that followed, the Irishman would find it hard to explain what he was waiting for in that moment. Was he waiting for his brother's initials to somehow unsign from that wretched sheet? Was he waiting for some acknowledgement, some confirmation, that he was making the right choice in betraying his kith and kin? If he ripped apart that paper, might it undo the damage that they had done? If he held that cigarette to the light of the sunrise long enough, would the bagpipes that bellowed the bars of Danny Boy begin to play? Then, like a seasoned fisherman gutting his midday catch, the Irishman sliced his thumbnail beneath the adhesive seal that bound his brother's rebel cigarette. Tobacco spilled across the young man's lap, dusting the prison floor. With the coiled casein writhing in his hand, the Dubliner smoothed the thin sheet against his knee. He did not need to check the paper to know what secrets that cigarette held. They were the same secrets he had written the night of their arrest. The same secrets he and his brother swore they would go to the grave protecting. The same secrets that would cost his brother his life. His face unable to mask his astonishment, Detective Lewis took the sheet from the prisoner and tilted the small page toward the window. January 3rd, Murphy's Provisions, 5:20 p.m. February 18th, Cullen City Market, 9:05 a.m. March 15th, Derry Street Pub, 11:10 a.m. In the corner of the sheet, the Irishman had signed the letters B and D. Below the prisoner's initials, the investigator could see the faded image of a bow and arrow, a stream of blood dripping from the barb. As orphans, we chose our names. With a shaking hand, the Dubliner pointed to the affidavit his brother had signed. Clyam, that's Irish for sword. Then he pointed to the unfurled cigarette. Boa, Irish for bow. And the surname? The detective's voice seeped with pity and admiration. It draped across the hilt of the arrowhead, said the Dubliner on the verge of collapse. Hanging from each is a sprig of mistletoe. Drulus,
Irish for mistletoe. Boa and clay for short. Unbelievable, whispered the detective under his breath. Now, please, detective, if you don't mind, give me the cell for a moment. Beau Drollis peered out the clouded window at the prison yard post. Of course, Mr. Drollis. I'll run my report. Let's see if I can hold up my end of the deal. The Irishman peered out the window. It was not until after the detective had mournfully closed the cell behind him that the Dubliner turned from his courtyard vigil. Detective Lewis? Footfalls returned from the hall. Yes, Beau? You've learned my surname, but I don't know yours. A long silence from the corridor. Then from the darkness, the detective answered, Key. Lewis Key. But those who know me well, just call me Low. And the detective was gone. Belfast, December 25th, 1971. The rattle of cups and plates against the iron bars of the prison hallway arose Beau Drollis from his shallow slumber. Sleep never came easily to the Dubliner. Now he doubted he would ever sleep again peacefully. The shouts of the Belfast inmates grew louder with each passing moment. Evident from their labored exclamations, a set of guards seemed to be dragging a prisoner down the corridor very much against his will. Beau peered out his cell for a closer look. It was then that he saw his brother's face for the first time since their arrest. Get your fucking hands off me, Clay Drollis barked as the guards jerked the furious combatant down the hall. Clay, can you hear me? Clay! In an instant, the Irishman's wounds of betrayal vanished. His brother needed him. Beau, for love of God, is that you? Like a child waking from a nightmare, Clay Drollis spun in the dimly lit hallway in search of his brother. Spotting Beau's face, Clay flung himself towards his brother's cell with enough force to dislodge the three guards ushering him down the corridor. When the sentinel grabbed his shoulder, Clay turned to him with a fire blazing in his eyes. Venom dripped from his lips. That man is my brother. You aren't worthy to tie the laces of his fucking shoes. If you don't remove your bloody hands and let a condemned man talk with his brother, I swear by whatever gods you worship north of this border, I will come back as a ghost and haunt these fucking halls until the day you die. With a begrudging groan, the guard lifted his hand and let the mistletoe brother speak. You look like shit, Beau, said Clay through a smile wet with crimson blood. Beau had trouble formulating his frantic thoughts. As a result, all that spilled from his lips were questions. Clay, what happened? What have they told you? Where are they taking you? Despite the circumstances, Clay had a smile on his face. I suppose they're bringing me to join our rebel pals at the faraway pub, he added with a wink. Don't worry, or I'll start us a tab. Beau felt the muscles that lined his jaw tighten. He swallowed hard. Tears pooled beneath his eyes. I'll fix this, Clay. Just give me another day. I'll talk with Detective Lowe. I'll figure it out. When Clay tightened his grip on the iron bars, it reopened a gash on his forearm. There's nothing else to be done, Beau. My jig is up. You pour one out for me each Christmas morning, you hear? When you're old and fat and happy, you tell that sweet wife of yours, whenever you meet the poor lass, that your brother was the bravest of the brave. You tell those kids, when you have them, how their old Uncle Clay fought those throne-bowing pricks until the bitter end. You hear me? Clay, why did you do it? Beau's voice cracked. Tears soaked his face. Why did you sign the sheet? If either of us was going to cave, I thought for sure it'd be me. Why, Clay? Why did you? They forged it, Beau. The blonde bastard sitting alongside us at the bar. That tall fellow with the Swedish flag on his forearm? He lifted my bill when I hit the loo. Probably called the alarm himself. They pulled my initials from that soggy old bar slip. Clay chuckled. You always told me that the drink would be my undoing. I guess you were right. Beau's gaze dropped to the floor. Clay, then it was me. I was the one. I'll hear not another word of it. Clay lifted his brother's drooping chin through the bars with one hand and shoved away an approaching guard with the other. Forget it. Fuck him. You get yourself out of here. Do you hear me? And you forget the whole fucking thing. You get out of here and you live. Don't you ever dip your hand into a barrel of gunpowder again, he added with a wink. If you do, when I'm done haunting this fat pig, you're next. In a blur, the guards were on him, wrestling him into submission and dragging him toward the door at the end of the hall. Still clutching the iron bars of the cell, Beau cried into the hollow belly of the Belfast prison. It was a cry for help. It was a cry for desperation. It was a lamenting cry, a defiant cry, the cry of a rebel. Detective Lowe, how could you? Detective Lowe, Detective Lowe, Key! Clay's howl grew softer with each step that carried him away from his brother. Get your hands off me, you tanny piece of shit. Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are. The door at the end of the prison hall slammed shut.
And that's the end of A Wrong Cruelly Done. All right, guys, I do hope that you enjoyed it. As I said before the recording, I want to give a little bit of a teaser for what it is that we're going to be talking about next. And that is the novel by Robert Ludlum, The Bourne Identity. Really looking forward to talking with Mike and Nick about that one. I just finished my rereading of it a couple of days ago, so it should be fresh in our brains when we make our way through this through our recording of it. So for those of you that are trying to follow along with our recordings and with the novels that we're reading, that is going to be our next book up. So Robert Ludlum's The Bourne Identity. Very different from the movie, though I'm sure that will come up as well. But The Bourne Identity is going to be the next book on our list. So thank you guys for listening. Again, michael.c.carroll is the Instagram handle, and hope you guys have a great rest of your summer. Keep listening, keep following along, keep sharing, and we'll be here for the start of our next season in just a couple of weeks. All right, thanks everyone.
Wrong Cruelly Done is written by Mike Carroll. The sound effects I got from freesound.org, including Brian Baltar's prison door closing and the busy bar ambient sound by Eric Clemens. The music that was kind of slowly haunting in the background is called Dewdrop Fantasy from Incomptech, used with the Creative Commons 4 license. Check out Kevin MacLeod on Incomptech. And then finally, of course, Sans is from our good friend Mr. Burns. So check out Davis Burns wherever he is. Thanks for listening and supporting us, and keep reviewing us wherever you get us. Thanks!